great deal of pleasure that I invite you to the first in a series of four lectures sponsored by the Department of Religion of the College of Liberal Arts. Particular welcome goes to those of you outside of the college community in the seminary and the graduate school. It's also with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce you to Alan W. Watts. He has been, during these past few weeks, lecturer at the New School in New York City. He is also a research fellow at Harvard University. In the past, he has been a religious counselor at Northwestern University, director of the Asian Institute in San Francisco, and is at present a lecturer and a writer. A number of his books are In the Spirit of Zen, The Legacy of Asia and Western Man, The Meaning of Happiness, The Supreme Identity, The Wisdom of Insecurity, Myth and Ritual in Christianity, Nature, Man, and Woman, This Is It. This Is It. Psychotherapy, East and West, and The Joyous Cosmology. He is preparing a book at present, which will have the title The Art of Godmanship, to be published in the fall. He was referred to very affectionately this afternoon by one of the undergraduates here at Drew as our favorite heretic. And our favorite heretic will talk on the subject this evening. Is it serious? Alan Watts.
Over the past 2 years, I've been thinking that there are really four fundamental philosophical questions, four deeply metaphysical problems which have been considered throughout the history of human thought. The first one is, who started it? The second, are we going to make it? The third, where are we going to put it? And the fourth, who's going to clean up? Only quite recently it occurred to me that there is a fifth question which should precede the others, and that is it serious? And in very, very general terms, when we contrast religious attitudes of the East and the West, and I'm going to make the most frightful oversimplification, the West answers, yes, it is serious, and the East answers, no, it isn't. I'm making a comparison here between Christianity and Hinduism. Because although it says in the book of Proverbs that the divine wisdom created the world in the spirit of play, nevertheless, the Christian tradition has been constantly haunted with the sense that there is in this universe the possibility of real and irrevocable tragedy. I suppose I'm talking in a fairly liberal context where people don't take it too literally that there is the possibility of eternal damnation. But that has been the idea that there could be eternal damnation has been one of the most powerful ideas in the whole history of mankind. That, in other words, a life, the life of an individual or the life of a society, could possibly end up in total, irremediable catastrophe. And if that is possible, you see, the fact of existence is very serious indeed. Because you walk on a tightrope. If you sway too one way too much, you're guilty of the sin of presumption. If you sway the other way too much, you're guilty of the sin of despair. To be too cocksure that everything is all right is wrong. To be sure that everything is all wrong is wrong. And you've got to tread that awkward middle path. Now, I have a long time, as you know, been a student of comparative religions. And the question of the relationship in particular between Christian theology and Hindu theology has always fascinated me. You know, when you consider the relationship between Christianity and Judaism, the Christians always claim that they include Judaism. The Christians take the Jewish scriptures as their Old Testament, whereas the Jews have never felt that they can include Christianity. Because if we are rather orthodox in our definition of Christianity and insist that the essential doctrine, the essential faith of a Christian, is that the historical Jesus of Nazareth was indeed God, this is what the Jew could not swallow. And so, from a certain point of view, you might say, Christianity has won over Judaism by being able to include it, whereas Judaism cannot include Christianity. Now, I want to put this possibility as to the relationship between Christianity and Hinduism. You see, in a vastly expanding world, Christianity is no longer the religion of an isolated culture centered around the Mediterranean and the Baltic. Christianity finds itself in the context of global history and global religion. And you see, where a thing is in context, its meaning may be profoundly altered by the context. That is to say, a word has meaning in accordance with the sort of sentence you find it in. And the meaning of a word may change without the word itself changing in any respect whatsoever. In one sentence, this tree has no bark. In another sentence, this dog has no bark. The identical word, but totally different meaning. We have seen historically Christianity as something in the context of a world which knew beside it only Greco-Roman cults, Mithraism, Judaism, and Islam. We now see it in the context of world religion. Maybe this context automatically makes a difference. But let's ask this question. If Christianity is true, can Hinduism be true too? And by Christianity here, I am going to mean, quite deliberately, something rather orthodox and naive, something anthropomorphic, because I have been more and more persuaded of the value of thinking in those terms, of thinking in mythological terms. Because if you think frankly of the Lord God sitting on his golden throne, you are much less liable to be fooled by that than if you think of God as necessary being or the undifferentiated aesthetic continuum. A frank idol is not so believable as an idol that appears as if it weren't an idol. So if we think of Christianity in quite an orthodox way and ask the question, could it, if it's true, can Hinduism be true? The answer is no. Because one of the central values of Christianity is to insist upon differences, the value of distinctions. As, for example, the distinction between good and evil, and the distinction between the creator and the creature, and the distinctions between one creature and another. I have heard sophisticated theologians say that if the distinction between good and evil is not an eternally real, serious, and important distinction, it is not a real distinction at all. And likewise also, that unless there is an eternal and fundamental distinction between God and man, then we have this awful thing, this dreadful heresy called pantheism. And pantheism is a horrible heresy, not only because it annihilates the reality, the eternal difference of all moral distinctions, but also insofar as it annihilates the distinction between God and man and between one person and another. It annihilates the possibility of love. As someone once said, just because I love sugar, I do not want to be sugar. And so in this way it is felt that unless there is an eternal division between the I and the thou, between one self and another, one person and another, and above all between the creator and the creatures, then a relationship between them, a relationship of love, becomes impossible. On the face of it, this is a very odd doctrine for Christians to maintain. Because, first of all, a Christianity in common with Judaism insists on the value of finite things. When the Lord created the finite world, as recorded in the book of Genesis, he saw that it was good. There is none of this nasty Gnostic Greek business whereby the material world is considered as a failure on the part of the Godhead, a degradation of spirit falling into matter. That, if anything, was the problem of the devil. Because his original sin was supposed to be accusing God of lese majeste in uniting himself with hairy animal beings and intending to have an incarnation and intending to raise a woman, the mother of God, to be to the rank of queen of the angels. No, the basic biblical doctrine is that the physical world is a good show. So, therefore, the finite, the physical, is good. And what is finite in space, which has limits, as your head is one end of you and the soles of your feet are the other, also there are good finite things in time. There are good things that don't last forever. I mean, imagine meeting a person who is infinitely tall. You wouldn't be able to notice him. You wouldn't be able to find out where his limits were. But so, in the same way, something that endures forever is very difficult indeed to notice. So good things don't last all the time. So an important distinction doesn't have to be an eternal distinction. But the difficulty was, I believe, that in the early origins of Christianity, they had to convert all those European barbarians. And they couldn't mince words or ideas with these simple people. They had to say, listen, good is good and bad is bad, forever and ever and ever. And if you do the wrong things, you will howl in hell forever and ever and ever. And if you do the right things, you'll rejoice in heaven forever and ever and ever. And that's that. You see, it's like teaching children arithmetic. You have to say, listen, two and two are four. And they are always and invariably four. Only when you get into higher mathematics do you consider such problems as the addition of 2 a.m. plus 2 p.m. Now, but you see this insistence, though, on the eternal distinction of good and evil is a very dangerous distinction, and it can be quite destructive of morality. To sanction morality with the Lord God, with the infinite and the eternal, is to put a sanction on good behavior, which is too heavy, sanction against bad behavior, which is too heavy. It's like running your electric shaver on a 2 million volt current. It blows up the thing. The Chinese say, don't swat a fly on a friend's head with a hatchet.
Thank you.
So to invoke the eternal justice of the Lord God in matters of whom you sleep with, whether you stole some money, etc., etc., is just too much. It's unnecessary. And it makes the Lord God a fool. But you see, though, there is a certain value in all this. There is a certain undeniable importance in insisting upon distinctions. And this is, in a way, the glory of Western civilization. Its valuation of every distinction in this cosmos as unique and important. The five sparrows that are sold for a farthing, you know, and they're all noticed. They're all important in the eyes of God. So you see, what Christians would object to in Hinduism is the Hindu doctrine called Tattvam Asi. Tat, that, it's the same word as that. Tvam, thou, Asi, art. The doctrine that every being is the Godhead in disguise. Because you see, whereas the Hebrew Christian analogy of the universe is according to the art of ceramics, clay taken by the potter and molded into intelligible form, the figurine of Adam made out of the dust of the earth and the breath of life blown into his nostrils so that he becomes animated. We see, therefore, matter as something basically unintelligent, basically passive, that needs something above it and beyond it, spiritual energy, to move it into significant form. But the Hindu analogy of the world is dramatics, not ceramics. And they see the Creator as the supreme actor who is playing all the parts that we are. All of you, deep down within yourselves, in the very center and origin and ground of your own selfhood, are the Brahman, the Godhead, playing hide-and-seek with himself and pretending that he's you. And so they have this idea of a dramatic universe. Now, think of some of the great conventions of the drama. The person, first of all. The dramatis personae. What are they? They are a list of the masks which the actors will wear to denote their characters, as they still do in no drama in Japan, and in the classical Greco-Roman drama, the mask used to be a megaphone formed to project the voice in the open-air theater, and hence the persona, that through which the sound goes. And in a curious inversion, the word person has come to mean the real and true identity, as distinct from merely the role or mask which the actor wears. But in this original meaning, persons, different persons, are different roles being played by you-know-who. And then there is the proscenium arch, which stands at the entrance to the stage. And that arch says, whatever happens on this side of the arch is in play. It is not serious. But the whole craft of the actor is to play so well that he almost convinces the audience that this is real life. And he has them on the edge of their seats in suspense, or he has them crying. And the supreme actor of all, the Lord of the universe, plays it so well that he even takes himself in. And in you, and you, and you, and you, you are all the Creator, taken in by the skill of his own act, and imagining that you are a separate individual. And so, throughout the eternal cycles, the Lord of the universe plays the game of hide and seek. For 4,320,000 years, by our calculations, he imagines that he is separate beings. And then there is a terrific catastrophe. Everything gets so at the ultimate limit of tragedy, you see. But it all blows up, and he wakes up and finds out, whew, what a relief that was. It was a good show, but it's a relief now it's over. And he is again himself in eternal peace, sat, chit, ananda, being, consciousness, bliss, which is the essence of Godhead, of the Atman, the Self. Then after another 4,320,000 years, he says, it's getting a little boring. Let's forget again. Let's dismember myself. This is the primordial sacrifice. The idea of why the sacrifice is life-giving, why it's creative. He dismembers himself in the beginning and he remembers himself in the end. And this goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. It's not a bad idea. Consider what you would do if you were God. What would you do if every night you could dream any dream you wanted? Any dream. I'm sure we'd all spend several months fulfilling our wishes. Then that would become a little boring, so we'd have adventures. We'd be princesses rescued by knights, or knights rescuing princesses from dragons, and then we'd have dreams where we didn't control what we were going to dream, we'd have surprise dreams. Then we'd dream. We decide to dream a whole lifetime in one night. Then we decide to dream many cycles of time in one night. Of course, we'd end up by dreaming the sort of thing that we're doing right now. Now you see, here is the problem. If the Hindu thing is true, if that's the way things are working, the traditional Christian is apt to feel some objections. I says, well, this is very difficult. This isn't serious. God is, after all, playing. As the Hindus say, the world is the lila, L-I-L-A, the sport of the Godhead. It is indeed the maya, the illusion, the dream, although the word also means art and magic. The maya of the Godhead. And we feel a little disquieted because it's lacking in a certain seriousness. But now, turn the tables. If the Hindu thing is true, can the Christian thing be true too? The answer is yes. With one provision, that it's not eternally true. It can be true for a while. And I can see very well how a Hindu might think. Christianity is a very far out religion. Very far out. It's the greatest adventure which the Godhead has thus far indulged in. Because the Christian soul is God forgetting that he's God completely. And imagining that he never was himself and could never get back to be himself. And that he stands in the awful gambler's situation of having to make a choice in this short life that he imagines himself to have between eternal beatitude and eternal perdition. What a gamble. You know how it is in actual gambling. When a man who is a skilled gambler has been working all evening and gradually winning, 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 and then towards the end of the evening, everybody in the casino is gathered around the table, and he suddenly stakes everything he has on whether it will be red or black. What a moment. What a real, terrific drama that is. And so the Hindu sees the Christian soul as exactly in that situation. As taking this choice, you know, once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide, taking this choice absolutely seriously and trembling on the brink of this awful possibility. Well, the Hindu Muslims say, bravo, it's magnificent.
C'est magnifique, mais ce n'est pas la guerre. it's a very wonderful thing, and he naturally applauds. And he can see, too, the way in which living that situation seriously and believing it has, in the course of time, in the course of the development of Western civilization, produced all sorts of values that would not have otherwise existed. It has produced our significant art, our music, our morals, our sense of social conscience, all kinds of things. But he would want to say, after all, in the final analysis, it's an illusion. It is, the word illusion is, of course, rooted in the Latin ludere, to play. It is a drama, and it isn't absolutely and ultimately so. He would go further, I think, and feel like this. It could be so. The illusion could last up to the very last second. You could even get the Lord disguised as you, the Christian soul, could even get to the point of being condemned to eternal damnation. And the hot trident of a devil could enter into the inmost sensitive area of the resurrected body and be twisted and turned to the most exquisite agony, and the most horrible screams would suddenly change, and the screaming voice would find itself saying, "I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end." Now, let us seriously consider this possibility as perhaps an insight that might bring greatly revived life to the Christian world. Because we've been playing for a long time, you see, that the soul of the individual is separate, and he is something alone. We speak of confronting the universe, facing reality. We talk about important spiritual encounters as confrontations. We've been playing that for a long time. But isn't there perhaps an element in the Lord God as the Bible and the traditions of the churches present him of what in the East would be called the Guru, the spiritual teacher, whose principal method of instruction is what the Hindus call upaya? Upaya means cunning. The cunning methods of the pedagogue. St. Francis Xavier used to talk about holy cunning as one of the arts of the missionary. And holy cunning is essentially the art of surprising a person out of his own egocentricity. See, there's no way of being unselfish or loving on purpose. A person who is being unselfish on purpose is, of course, a hypocrite. He's faking his unselfishness. He doesn't really love his neighbor. No, he doesn't really like colored people, but he goes around with them because it's the good thing to do, or something like that. And so he is something lacking in his, he's not genuine. But the whole teaching of the gospel is that you must be genuine. See, it's enough. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. But you've not only got to do the will of the Lord, you not just go through the motions. It says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That is no faking. Now, this is surely upaya. Let's look at the history of upaya in the Christian tradition. St. Paul is very clear about it. He says that the Lord never expected that the law of Moses would be obeyed. But he delivered the law to Moses in order to convict men of sin. That is to say, by setting an ideal before them, which they could never live up to, he made them conscious of how selfish they were. Something else, then, is needed beyond law, and that is grace. Only the divine grace can make it possible for man to live in accordance with the divine will. So there had to be something over and above the rules. You will remember that was the fight between Augustine and Pelagius. Pelagius said, if the Lord God gave us a law, obviously there was no point in giving the law unless it could be obeyed. Augustine said nothing of the kind. He agreed with St. Paul. And that's been the general feeling of the Christian tradition. So if the law was given, not in the expectation that it should be obeyed, people were to try to obey it, only to find out that they couldn't. That is exactly what a Hindu means by upaya, a skillful means on the part of the teacher to get you to realize something. We might say it's deceit. It's like a doctor using a placebo. He somehow fools the patient into health. But why wouldn't all the great teachers of the East certainly have done that? Because they have a certain humor. And it's very curious how it has been difficult for us to see humor in our conception of God. Is there a twinkle in the Father's eye? You don't see it very often. Because the Holy Scriptures, when they are read in church, are usually read as if one was pronouncing an extremely solemn utterance. A book in which there are no jokes. I'm sure that if we should have a conception of God that is at least as lofty as any saint or any human being who ever lived, he would have the most human of all virtues, the virtue of humor, which is the same word as human, after all. And humor is the quality, you see, of not taking oneself seriously. Chesterton once said that the angels fly because they take themselves lightly. And if that may be true of the angels, how much more of the Lord of the angels? So then, there might be some humor in the precepts of the Bible, especially in this first and great commandment, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. In other words, you must have grace. Think that one over. It's just as difficult to get grace as it is to obey the law. Because you have to ask for it sincerely. You have to really mean it. How do I really mean it? You must really mean it. You see? It's like a mother says to a child, now, darling, you ought to love your mother. You really ought to. But of course, I wouldn't want you to do it just because I say so, but because you really want it. What happens if you ask your wife, do you really love me? And she answers, well, I'm trying my very best to do so. What kind of an answer do you want? You want her to say, yes, I love you so much I could eat you. Holy Communion. See, really. But when you say to a human being, I require you to do, I command you to do, those things which will only please me if you do them spontaneously. You are committing what is called a double bind. You are giving two messages which are contradictory. And people are always doing that to each other. In fact, most of us are existing in a state of chronic double-mindedness, because we have been told by our society and our parents and our schools and our peers, you must be free. You shall be responsible. And it comes at us in every direction. That's why we're so mixed up. Well, how are we going to unmix us? You see? Well, you unmix by a homeopathic process. What every great spiritual teacher does is this. He tells his students to commit the mistakes that they are committing consistently and vigorously. Peccate fortiter. See? Sin mightily. This is Luther. So that by doing this consistently, you discover there's a contradiction in it. See, if you firmly believe that the earth is flat, you don't merely believe that it's flat, you know it's flat. You can see it's flat. Any fool can see it's flat. And no amount of argument will convince you. So what I say, if I do want to convince you, I say, well, if the earth is flat, wouldn't it be fun to go and look over the edge? Only to get to the edge, we've got to be consistent. In other words, we've got to go exactly westwards all the time along latitude 40, so that we know we'll get to the edge, and we won't just be going round in circles. Right? We behave consistently, and we arrive back where we started. So your flat earthist now knows that the earth is at least cylindrical. And he'll probably believe you now, after this experiment, that it's round the other way, too. So in the same way, there has obviously, the Judeo-Christian philosophies are perfectly right in feeling that there has been some event which we might call the fall of man. The Hindu would say, of course, that the fall was the moment when the Supreme Self started pretending it was the separate individual. That was the fall. It wasn't really a bad thing, it was a great and marvelous drama. But that was the fall, that was the down path. We could look at it in another way. It was the moment when we ceased to trust ourselves. When we felt that our nature, our so-called instincts and our bodies with their natural appetites were not trustworthy, and that we had to stand over ourselves with a club and supervise everything we do. And we've been suffering from that, you see. Because when you conduct your conduct by careful reflection and thinking, you get anxiety. Because you live in time. You predict the future by the study of the past. And the more you know about time, the more you realize that you come to an end in time. The knowledge of future helps you to survive, but it also discourages you. And you wonder sometimes whether it's worth surviving. Also, you never know when you think things through carefully whether you've thought about them enough. When you collect data as the basis for your judgment, you never really know whether you collected enough data. You know, the sort of person who leaves the house and wondered if they turned off the gas stove. They go back and take a look, yes, it's turned off. And they go out again, gee, I wonder if I really looked. No? Sort of thing. And so we get anxiety. And we have a kind of nostalgia for the idea that there was, perhaps a time, way, way in the past, it may be a memory of childhood, it may be an interuterine state, it may be something far off we remember, but there was a time when we didn't have to stop to think. We acted spontaneously. And it wasn't necessary to make plans. Of course, it's all there in the New Testament. Be not anxious for tomorrow. Be like the wild birds, flowers of the field. most subversive passage in the whole Bible. No sensible person would dream of following it. But there it is. Because the meaning of that passage is, I tell you to do this so that you can find out why you can't. I tell you, you must love your neighbor so that you can find out why you can't. I tell you, you've committed adultery when you glanced at the pretty girl across the street and lusted after her in your heart. Do you think you could not do that? You think you've committed a sin when you bawled your brother out and hated him. But I tell you, you mustn't even call him a silly idiot. Thou fool, you know. Can you do that? So, all these techniques call in question our characteristic sense of personal identity. That is to say, they call in question the basic feeling that most of us have, that we are an independent agent or origin of actions encapsulated within a bag of skin. That is the feeling that we have, you see, that we look out upon this universe through these eyes and see that which is other, which is alien, as if we didn't really belong here at all. I mean, it's like most people seem to think of the world as a dead tree on which we've all alighted like birds that came from somewhere else altogether, rather than a tree which produces us like leaves and fruit. We lack, as Westerners particularly, Easterners do it too, but we particularly lack a sense of belonging here. That's why we talk about conquering nature, and why our great symbol of the conquest of nature is the bulldozer, the thing which shoves it all aside. That's because the sense of identity is locked up in here. So what the spiritual master does is to say, all right, you think you're the separate identity. So I will give you a few tasks to do. If you are so free as you think, so independent as you think, do something perfectly spontaneous. See? Try for the next 3 minutes not to think of a green elephant. It's like saying to a child, you know, with all the relatives are present, and they put the child in the middle and say, now, darling, play. So these tests are made. And finally, the awful test. See, this is what Christianity really clobbers you with. You have to confront this marvelous image of the crucifix. I remember when I was a little boy, we used to go on Good Friday to church, and every child who went out was presented with a colored picture of the crucifixion. And in Gothic letters it said underneath, "This have I done for thee, what doest thou for me?" And you felt awful. It wasn't. Somehow you were responsible for this. You had put in those nails. And this had all been done. Here was somebody who in some way represented God, who had done everything for you. You're like a good parent. And the parents come on sometimes, don't they, to you and say, look all I've done for you. I gave you an education. I worked myself to the bone to support you. And here you are. You so-and-so. So in the same way, this terrifying thing, enlarge it. What does this crucifix really mean? It means that you cannot live 2 seconds without taking something's life. You may be a vegetarian, but you're hurting the apples. You're tearing up the vegetables. It hurts them. You squeeze their life. You do. You cannot live without exploiting somebody else. And so that figure is the image of it. And says, now what are you going to do about it? Well, what are you going to do? To throw up everything and become a medical missionary? Dispensing as an act of mercy to the hapless Africans or whatever, drugs made by firms that are getting fat on the ridges of nostrums. What are you? The awful thing that really stops you is you realize you can't do anything about it. And that doesn't help you because also you can't do nothing about it. So then you see deeper as you look into this figure. You see it isn't only that it's somebody else hanging on the cross, it's you. You're also tacked up there. And you see the lesson of this is that your sense of identity is false. You have played the game that you as an individual could or could not do something about it all. And so there comes then the moment of total frustration, of realizing that you can't do something and you can't do nothing. You can't do something to love your neighbor or to love God. You can't get the love of God by doing nothing and just sitting around until the grace hits you. And this moment is the dissolution of the illusion of separateness. This can come to people in all kinds of different ways, not only through a course of religious commitment. It also can come in catastrophe, where you hear the bomb screaming over your head and you think this is the end and there's nothing to do but accept it, and the bomb turns out to be a dud. And you live to remember that in the moment when you accepted your own conclusion, you became free. Because you realized in that moment when you gave yourself up because there was nothing else you could do but give yourself up. You didn't do it as something virtuous. When you stopped, as it were, contracting like this, spiritually and psychologically, you found out who the real you was. In ancient and mystical terms, we might say the real you is the self, the divine ground, the cosmic mind, or whatever. In modern terms, we should say, we find out that the organism is one with its environment, that the real identity of the organism is what we would call an organism-environment field. The behavior of the organism is the behavior of the environment, and the behavior of the environment is the behavior of the organism. This is respectable, currently scientific jargon, which will do instead of the religious jargon for those people who find the religious jargon unpalatable. But the end of that is, you see, that the only that person gives up himself, who no longer takes himself seriously, and who sees that the sense of the separate ego, with its anxiety and with its guilt, is a game of hide, of which the end will sometime be seek. Now that is really the fundamental thing. Now you see it, now you don't. This is the game which entertains, and this is how you know it's genuine. It's the basic game for all babies. Take a baby, hide your face behind a book. Look out, hide it. Look out again, the baby will start to giggle. Because the baby giggles, because you know you found out the baby's game that he had just in the minute before he became a baby. Now, I presume we have some time in which you might like to ask questions. Might I suggest, though, that we have about 1 minute's intermission in case some of you have to leave, and you can do so comfortably without disturbing the rest. Now, my friends, if you will wave a hand at me and have questions, I'll do my best to answer them.
You've spoken so much of the Hindu approach toward the game. Is it serious? And how we all tend to be a part of the Godhead while he acts out his little play. What part does death play in this ritual?
The question is, what is the part played by death in the Hindu theory of the universe as the Lord's game of hide and seek? Death is the forgettery. It is the means of constantly renewing the surprise. In other words, the death of the individual is the dissolution of his aggregation of memories. When you were born, you suddenly became a baby, and you looked on the world as if you had never seen it before. When you die, you enter into the same state as you were before you were born. You see, it's a complete phantasm to imagine oneself not existing forever. That's a very unthinkable idea. It isn't even a sensible idea. It doesn't mean a thing. There is always somebody who exists, and that's you. You see, all you could say, your name is I. That's my name. See? It's a very simple idea, but it's unfamiliar, and therefore a little difficult sometimes to grasp. It doesn't matter. I mean, if the whole human race were blown up by an atomic bomb, there are probably other human races all over the place, but even if there aren't, it's only a matter of probability. It might be several billion years before another human race arose. But that billions of years would be as nothing at all. Just in the same way as between sleep, going to sleep and waking up in the morning, it is as no time at all. So, I mean, don't worry. The fundamental conviction, you see, of Indian mysticism is that the ground of you is it. That's what there is. And to know that, see, is the thing that enables one to participate in life with greater zest than ever. You know you've nothing to lose, and so you can gamble with complete abandon. Yes, sir.
Your own death obviously is nothing, absolutely. However, I think you have a sudden blues in the death of it, and I have a hard time denying my own service on that.
Yes, because you see, you have to endure the death of other people.
Yeah.
See, when they're gone, you suffer their absence, or you suffer guilt if you've been responsible in some way by neglect or something for their going. And that's the hard thing to take. It's other people. But if you carefully think through the idea, I recommend this to you as an experiment. Instead of avoiding wishful thinking, try to devise a religion which is as wishful as possible, taking into consideration all the tragedies and pains of this life as we know it. What theory of the universe would you find completely satisfying and make up for them? Think that problem through. You get some very interesting answers. Yes, sir.
Isn't the Hindu view of the world as a joke, a rather biting, sarcastic type of joke? Wouldn't you say that when the world is viewed as an illusion, this being a form of humor is a rather hard, sour type of joke that somebody or something is playing upon us? Isn't there a more down-to-earth, real humor, perhaps more in the Chinese vein than the Indian vein, perhaps?
Did you all hear the question? Of course, when you speak of the world as a joke or as play, we mustn't forget that in current usage, these words have at least two very different meanings. One is the sense of delight, the laughter of the joke, the genuine humor. The other is the sense of the pratfall, the trivial joke. You are merely jesting with me, as we might say. That you don't have respect for this, you merely jest, you see? Now those, in the same way, play. We can speak of the divine comedy in the sense in which Dante used the word comedy. But we could speak also of comedy as a burlicue show, you know? And they're two very different things, in a way. Two different spirits. But since, generally speaking, when we approach divine matters, we are not accustomed in our standards, in our system of values, to introduce the element of comedy. And therefore, it initially strikes us as a sort of cheapening, as a lack of respect. But someone once said, you know, dear Lord, if you will forgive my many little jokes about thee, I will forgive you your big joke on me. When you really come down to it, if the Hindu view is true, it isn't that the Lord is playing a joke on us as his little victims. He's played it on himself and himself only. Nobody has been given an unfair deal. Nobody has been used contemptibly and without respect. It's a sobering thought.
We've read about the LSD experiments up at Harvard, and we've also read that you've taken part in them. I wonder if you'd like to say something about that, particularly in terms of the relationship of experience with a drug and a religious experience.
It's very interesting that I have been asked this question on every college and university campus I have been to in the past many months. Usually it's the first question immediately after the lecture. Well, in the context of our culture, where we believe firmly that nothing worthwhile is achieved without pain, it's very embarrassing when it turns out that there is a simple physical method of helping a person to have mystical experience. This really doesn't do at all. It's against our New England conscience. But unfortunately, it's true. What are we going to do about it? I really don't know. You know, Although from the beginning the Christians always said, in order to receive the gift of eternal life, you only need to be baptized. It's very simple. All we have to do is pour water on it. Water is available everywhere. It's very cheap. And we say, I baptize thee in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. And that you're saved right there. It's just that easy, because God loves you, and he wants to make it easy, see? So, now something else happens, but it's in tune with the scientific age. Baptism was in tune with a different kind of age. And scientific age thinks of these things in a different way. And so suddenly people are discovering that you can get a look into heaven, or whatever you want to call it, by using certain instruments. Now, we've always known we could look up by using a telescope. Now, is it cheating to use a telescope? Ought you somehow to do some yoga exercises to train your eyes to magnify the stars to enormous dimensions? Ought you not to use a microscope? Well, there are not only instruments that you use outside your skin, there are instruments you can put inside your skin. I mean, you can be given a new silver throat if you lose your ordinary one. False teeth, even synthetic plastic parts to the heart, so on. And what these chemicals do, drugs is a loaded word, because when we say drug, we think of someone drugged or doped, a sort of human wreck tottering around in a state of total incapacity. You know, sort of a Fu Manchu opium den with screaming memes at the end of the line. And, these things aren't like that. What they do is intensify awareness and open it. Awareness is usually narrow, like a spotlight. By certain means, it can be opened and become like a floodlight. But of course, when you use things of this kind, there's potential danger. And that's disconcerting to our culture at present, because we live under the superstition that you can live without danger. That's why everybody worships insurance policies. You know, security, all the banks call Security First National, Rock of Gibraltar, you know, Guarantee Investment Trust, etc. As if the word is security. And now, we say the proverb says nothing ventured, nothing gained. If you don't gamble, you don't get anywhere. All right? Just as the pioneers of the American West took great risks to explore that unknown territory and settle it, so if you're going to explore the unknown depths of the mind, you're going to take risks. And you may run into the danger of a psychosis, but I don't think that is any more dangerous than a wild Indian. You've got to take risks, and there are risks in these things, and therefore they have to be used with a certain care and responsibility. But all the hullabaloo and fear and scaredness about them is just, it's a newspaper sensation. Yes, sir.
I can quite see how a Christian can step outside and sort of laugh at himself by stepping into the role of a Christian, or in other words, I'm just passing through and this world is really taken seriously, that eventually there is eternity. But I find it a little difficult to see how you can step outside of yourself as a Hindu and yet be able to laugh at yourself. You see, sort of, I can't quite see how a Hindu can really tell what he's playing the role.
What would make the difference? Why does one have the ability to step outside and the other not?
Well, a Hindu is apparently presuming that, you know, things go on and on and on and on.
Yes.
Cyclically.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
The Christian sort of presumes that eventually it will all end, excuse the word, cataclysmically, I think.
Yes.
And then he will then go on in eternity with bliss, but...
Yeah.
I don't see how the Hindu can be have such an abandon as the Christian can. In other words, I don't see what would motivate a Hindu martyr.
Well, there have been lots of them. You must see, first of all, that the Hindu can see the possibility within the divine unity for there being differences. But the differences are always subordinate to the unity. The unity is more real than the differences, but the differences are still real. He can have this point of view, which I've always thought characteristic of a mature attitude to anything. This maturity consists in being able to distinguish the more important from the less important without thinking the less important unimportant. And therefore, within this cosmology, there are moments, you see, when the unity is completely forgotten and where everything seems to be as serious as possible. And then when you wake up from that, you laugh.
Waking up from that.
Huh?
You said waking up.
Yes.
So you could wake up somewhere else.
Yeah, you wake up, in other words, and you discover that your fear was like a nightmare. And where is the nightmare when you finished it? Yes.
Did you accept the theory that the mind is not in the brain is a vehicle for the mind?
The question is, would I accept the theory that the mind is not in the brain, but that the brain is a vehicle for the mind? I might accept it, although I'm not quite sure of the meaning of your terms. I would accept it in this way. I certainly don't think that the mind is in the brain. I think the brain is in the mind. So is the organism. But my meaning of the word mind is not some kind of different substance from what we call the physical universe. What I mean by my mind is the total structure of the physical universe as it is focused upon this organism. In other words, it is the complete network of communications ultimately coextensive with the whole world, as linked at this point, as focused at this point. And so that all of us share ultimately the same mind, but interconnected in different ways. So I feel that I have a physical description for what I mean by mind. Mind is the order of relationships. And so it includes all our intercommunications with each other. You can't think without words very well, but words are given to you by the social context in which you live. Yes, sir.
From what you've just said, would it be simpler to perhaps think of yourself as part of the process than would be the case if you had the New England conscience frame of reference, perhaps? Part of a continuing and ongoing process rather than a separate piece to which life happens.
That's right. In other words, you feel that the real you, it isn't something you have to look at. It isn't something you have to be able to catch hold of. Just in the same way, I know, without having to be able to see my brain. There was a young man who said, though it seems that I know, what I would like to see is the eye that knows me when I know that I know that I know. But you never get to that. Because that's the foundation. There's no need to get to it. Leave it alone. You see? But that's unconscious. You don't need to be conscious of it. But it's always there. And you can drop dead, you see, you can vanish, but it's still there. And up it pops again in another form. Always, 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 always. Yeah?
Yes, sir.
You illustrated what might be a possible reinterpretation of Christianity, the fit into concepts in the New Testament materials. Are there any other parts, either in the history of Christianity or in present interpretations of Christianity, that could use to illustrate the same thesis of reinterpretation?
Yes, you're right in saying that I drew my illustrations mainly from the New Testament. And you ask if there are other parts or epochs, schools of Christianity that would could be presented in the same way, is that it? Indeed there are. I mean, I could go into the whole sacramental system of the Catholic Church and use it in this way. I could give a long discourse on the liturgy or the Mass from this point of view, from the point of view of the "this is my body," eating the Holocaust of the world, where all life feeds on life and the relation of this to the Mass. I could discuss the so-called mystical theology in the tradition of Dionysius Pseudo-Areopagite and John Scotus Origena and Meister Eckhart and St. Teresa and so on and so on. I could discuss the mysticism of the Orthodox Church, the Hesychasts, the Jesus Prayer, and many, many different aspects of the Christian tradition. Even I could discuss the most abominable aspect of Christianity, which is the Bible Belt Christianity of the United States, which is a very far out situation of the Lord indeed. The Lord playing non-play. The Lord playing ultimate gloom. And we would find there still, you see, the inner, suppressed, amazing delight of the scene. Our time is short. Any more questions? Yes, sir, right at the back.
If everything is separate, as Larry is saying, isn't it possible that the desire for people to be given an equal hand, to have equal rights, being likewise treated in the humorous manner, was pushed to one side? Or is this taken into consideration in
Well, of course, the whole problem of equality and equal rights. Do you know that it originates right out of Christian mysticism? The esoteric inner doctrine is that all men are equal in the sight of God. And equal means fundamentally equal to God. All men are equal. I am I am I am I am I am I am I. And that's a very dangerous doctrine. And so it's esoteric. Now, what happened was that this doctrine leaked. And it came out through the German mystics and such groups as the Brothers of the Free Spirit, the Anabaptists, and the Levellers, eventually the Quakers, and it is the foundation of democratic political theory. But by and large, democratic political theory tends to be a parody of the mystical doctrine, because the way it works out in practice is that all men are equally inferior and have equal rights to be treated rudely by the bureaucrats. It's very, very instructive to consider these parodies. You see, the fashion we had for a kind of pseudo-Freudian debunking. It used to be a few years ago that the formula for a successful biography was to take the life of someone who had hitherto been thought to be a paragon of virtue, and show that, after all, his whole intellectual or moral life was nothing but a compensation for his traumatic experiences in toilet training. Or that he was really some very, very sticky kind of pervert, only it was all covered up and this was sublimated into his saintliness. See? That is a great formula to show that everybody is as vulgar as I am. We have to be aware of that in equal rights. The problem, I think, if I may just say a word about equal rights, the thing that really disturbs me is this. We base our propaganda on a negative position, which is that it is wrong of you whites not to give equal rights to the Negroes. What we should be doing is making propaganda that shows the beauty of Negroes to the whites. What would be the constructive possibilities of their having rights equal with us? You see, take for example simply physical beauty. A lot of people don't think that Negroes are physically beautiful. They have never been shown. Their scales haven't been taken off their eyes. And so they should see photographers and painters go to work and show that they, by thinking that a Negro looks uncivilized or ape-like or some nonsense of that kind, what they're missing. Just as we've seen ourselves by the work of great artists. But there's no accentuation in so many forms of political propaganda for various perfectly worthwhile ideals. There is no accentuation of the vision. There is no vision. There's only condemnation and recrimination, and you ought not. And that's not enough. The history of preaching is that it's a failure. That's its historical lesson. Now, I think that probably we should draw this to a close, and may I say thank you for the pleasure of being allowed to think out loud in your company.